The following program is brought to you by We Are Many. To learn more about this program or to find others like it, check out wearemany.org.
What did he have to say? He basically said, and I had a quote on the slide, capitalism can't be transcended from within capitalism itself, but through socialism, true socialism with equality and justice. He pointed out that in Venezuela they were trying to build what he called a social economy, that it was specifically not like that in the Soviet Union. He said that what it would be would emerge as we develop through participatory democracy systems that are built on cooperation, not competition. He said we cannot resort to state capitalism. He said that would be to imitate and to fall back into the errors of the Soviet Union. He said what he wanted was a humanist socialism, one that puts human beings, not machines, and not the state, ahead of everything else. Now, in order to set up Ava's analysis of what's happening today in Venezuela after Chavez's death, it helps to have some historical background. What was Venezuela like before and during Chavez's various presidencies? What did socialism for the 21st century mean in both theory and in practice? During Chavez's youth and growing up, Chavez was born in 54. From 1958 on through Chavez's election, this political system present in Venezuela was known as Punto Fijismo, that is a kind of political pact between the two dominant parties signed in Punto Fijo, the two parties being Acción Democrática and COPEI, and it essentially was a system that was a power-sharing agreement among the two major bosses of political parties with respect to elections, to include each other in government, and to share a basic political program. That political program was neoliberalism. It came under COPEI and Caldera. Later on, it was prosecuted or put forward by Acción Democrática, and in particular, the worst forms of it, the most intense forms of neoliberalism, came in the period of Carlos Andrés Pérez's last administration, 1989 to 1993. For those of you, probably everybody knows by now what neoliberalism is, but it's a package also known as the Washington Consensus that is the things we're all familiar with: privatization, cuts in social services, pro-business tax policies, elimination of regulations on capital accumulation, reduction of the national debt, fiscal discipline, and opening to foreign investment. You can imagine the kinds of social protests, pretty unorganized, often spontaneous, but the point is they represented a growing accumulation of anger on the part of Venezuelan society against the system, and in particular against the politics ran that system. It led initially, as throughout Latin America, to manifestations of guerrilla warfare. This was brutally repressed under Acción Democrática administrations, along with social resistance from below. There were over 3,000 tortured and killed in operations during that period, a thing appropriately called the Waldorf-Astoria Agreement, essentially produced a system in which Venezuela became an oil state integrated into U.S. imperialism. By the 1970s, there was a sharp contrast between growing marginal urban populations and the extravagant wealth of a tiny minority. The period 73-74 was known as Saudi Venezuela. That is, you had people running all over the world from the tiny elite, spreading money everywhere. The oil profits flowed out of the country to the multinationals, and there was a small, skilled working class, but it was held down, it was kept down because of its privileged position in the oil industry vis-a-vis the rest of society. Now, Chavez himself was young when Punto Fijismo was first set up, but he progresses, on through to adulthood. In 54, he's born in a small provincial town. He was educated on scholarships. He was all his life committed to making education accessible for all of society. He retained his popular wit and manner of speaking, and this, of course, angered his critics in the white upper middle class, who looked at him essentially as a vulgar black barbarian. In 1975, Chavez graduates from military academy. His readings include Simón Bolívar, Simón Rodríguez, Ezequiel Zamora, the contemporaries of Bolívar. And I had slides that showed all this, blah, 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 blah. He also read Juan Velasco Alvarado, who was a military guy who became president of Peru. He deeply influenced Chavez in his formative period. And the thing about Alvarado was his government eventually fell because it seemed not to include any civilians. It was basically a kind of military thing, and it had lost contact with civil society. Federico Brito, other distinguished Marxists, both in Venezuela or Colombia, then, of course, Fidel Castro, Salvador Allende, and Che Guevara. The thing they all had in common was they were staunch anti-imperialists. And that is the thing that will kind of be consistent throughout Chavez's discourse and actions, that is, staunch anti-imperialism. The main influence, according to many people, I tend to agree with this, is a kind of Bolivarian conception. You know, he called the Venezuelan Revolution the Bolivarian Revolution. And from that, you know, he took the ideas of Bolivar, that is, a general, you know, a single individual who could lead and inspire and stand up to the mightiest superpowers of his day and win. But within Bolivarianism, there is this kind of central tension between, I mean, there's a tension between the central role of of the leader, you know, and a dedication to Latin national liberation and democracy. And you'll see that in Chavez always. On the one hand, the focus on his historic role as an individual, you know, his distrust, mistrust of political parties, which you can understand from the kind of system he grew up in, but was also completely consistent with Bolívar. And then on the other hand, all the dedication on Chavez's part and attempts to theorize modes of participatory democracy. The military side always kind of edged out more and in some cases was dominant in Chavez. In 1977, he founded a secret military group called the Ejército de Liberación del Pueblo de Venezuela, ELPV. In 1982, he founds the group that actually plans the 1992 coup and carries it out. It fails, and that's the MBR 200, that is Movimiento Bolivariano Revolucionario in 200 for 200 years of Bolívar. Okay, so how does this political thought develop after that formation coming out of the military academy? Well, in the 80s, he meets two people, both of whom had backgrounds in the guerrilla struggle. One was Alfredo Manero of Causa Aérea, who had sort of a view of the spontaneity of the masses. At one point was kind of close to sort of Maoist conceptions of things. And then Douglas Bravo of the Fuerzas Armadas de Liberación Nacional, which was sort of the major guerrilla group. And from that, from them, he gets the idea of a civic military alliance. This was implicit and in all the, sometimes explicit in the readings he'd had before, but they emphasized to him the need for connections to the world of the civilian world, not just military conspiracy. In 1989, February 1989, most people agree that's when the Venezuelan Revolution began. And this is the event known as the Caracazo, which was a gigantic rebellion in Caracas. It is a great story. I love to tell it. I love to illustrate it with dramatic episodes. And I act it out, and I usually put on some, you know, appropriate clothing for the occasion. And I loot whoever is next to me, and destroy something. However, we don't have time for that today, so I'm going to skip the drama and just point out that the Caracaso convinced Chavez that even though he still thought the military leadership had to be primary in the revolution, it convinced him of the need to coordinate the two, both the military and the civic struggle. I have a slide that I wish you could see. It's George Bush as the devil eating the UN. And this is the famous episode where Hugo Chavez stood up in front of the UN after George Bush had spoken and kind of sniffed around and said, "It smells like sulfur," right? Sulfur being the smell associated with the devil. So I don't know, some wit on those free images you can get on Wikipedia has made a slide called Stinko del Diablo. You know, for those of you who don't know Spanish, that's not really Spanish. But anyway, it gets the point across that George didn't smell so good that day. Or ever, exactly. So what you have there represented is the consistent and vicious attack of imperialism on Chavez and the Bolivarian Revolution. In 1998, he's elected president of Venezuela. By the early months of 2002, just as happened in Chile with the election of Salvador Allende in the 1970s, the bosses organized economic instability and food shortages of other commodities, etc. By April 2002, there's a right-wing military coup to supposedly restore order because all these shortages and everything have produced social unrest and protest. This is the famous episode where, over the course of the next couple of days, from the hillsides, the barrio, poor barrio hillsides of Caracas, the urban masses spill down, essentially defeat the revolution and get Chavez restored to power. After that, the two highlights are the December 2002, the economic coup. That is when the bosses, especially in the oil industry, decide to kind of economically destroy and bring down Chavez. That's resisted by the masses again, both in forms of social protest, but also their willingness to bear the brunt of the kinds of privations enforced on them by the bosses' economic terror. In August 2004, there's a recall referendum staged by the right that Chavez wins with an extremely large a majority. So those things are both defeated, but they're defeated by mass actions, you know, that essentially are organized around the individual Chavez and what he symbolizes and represents for so many Venezuelans. Now, what might 21st century socialism have looked like in Venezuela? In 2004, 2006, significant experiments in some advances in participatory democracy took place. Many of you will be familiar with the misiones, things like Barrio Adentro, the medical missions into the poor neighborhoods, the misiones Robinson, Ribas, Sucre, the educational missions, Mercado, the food supermarket mission. All of this was important. Also, at the same time, Chavez had kind of decreed, coming out of the constitutional reforms in 1999, the Consejos Comunales. These were sort of organs of local control of policy making and projects for community development. If you're familiar with the Brazilian experiment at some point, the participatory budget, it's kind of along those lines. And then also, in this period, efforts were made to run PDVSA, that is the, by that point, nationalized Venezuelan oil company, to run it in a collective and democratic way. Now, these events, these developments, are actually important embryos of what might have developed had Venezuela moved forward toward the kinds of goals that I referenced in the beginning that Chavez set out in Porto Alegre in the Gigantinho Stadium. So how and why were these impulses toward creating a genuine alternative to Venezuela's neoliberal state blocked and eventually allowed to atrophy? Well, there are contradictions of what we might as well call actually existing 21st century socialism. And they're evidenced in Venezuela in a very stark fashion. First of all, politics. A writer, Ian Bruce, has referred to it as the Bolivarian paradox. In other words, how is it possible for a movement from below to develop an independent collective leadership in a political culture completely dominated by a single individual? All these electoral campaigns, all of the arguments around the revolution centered around Chavez, no? And without Chavez, there was not an identity for the Bolivarian Revolution in most people's heads. In that context, how do you develop an organic collective leadership? How does it arise out of the actions and self-activity of the masses? There's an economic fundamental contradiction, and that is that the kind of development promised by the Bolivarian Revolution from the outset, namely a diversification of the economy and the creation of new industries that could supply domestic needs, this did not happen. After 10 years of Chavez, Venezuela still imported 80% of its food. And no matter what people say about the agricultural reforms and their intentions and this, that, and the other, the reality is the agricultural sector was never kind of rebuilt to the point where Venezuela could move toward breaking its role in the world economy of being an exporter of primary materials, oil, and having to import virtually everything else. In short, Venezuela remained and remains an oil state. It occupies the same place after Chavez as it did before Chavez in the global economy, despite the fact that it's some of its new ties are with China and Russia. Much has changed, or much did change, but Venezuela, like Bolivia, remains a producer of primary materials for the dominant centers of the world. Socialism from above. Now, one of the most fundamental contradictions was represented in the idea of an attempt to bring about socialism through the existing state. Essentially, where politics and economics come together in Venezuela under Chavez is with a thing that scholars refer to as, they refer to it in commentators in Venezuela, as the endogenous right, that is the homegrown right, the right that comes out of the Bolivarian Revolution itself. This is essentially the Chavista bureaucracy that visibly gains power throughout this period, increasingly so. Most of the institutions are there. Some of the people change, but essentially they're at the whim of Chavez. But once they're in there, they begin to develop a kind of life of their own, sort of bureaucratic interests of their own. This is, and according to many analysts, a formation of a new class. Each member here controls economic and political structures in an intimate relation with the military. As I begin to close, I should say something about the PSUV, the PSUV. All right? I'll just limit it to a quote because it kind of says it all. Mike Gonzalez, who's written a recently published short, important book on Hugo Chavez, says this: "A mass ruling party that simply arises out of the will of a leader cannot claim to be organic to the revolutionary process, nor the product of popular democracy." The PSUV was decreed by Chavez. It put real revolutionaries in a difficult position. If you wanted to have contact with outside yourself, you didn't want to be a little sect, you wanted to have contact with real struggles, real groups of workers and poor, and etc., you had to kind of be in it. But to be in it meant you were subject to an extremely top-down lack of internal democracy, essentially bureaucratically controlled entity. That made the PSUV essentially an instrument of the state, very little separation, if any, actually I would argue none, between the state and the party that was supposed to be the, quote, vanguard party of the oppressed and the exploited in Venezuela. So essentially, what you have in the case of Chavez or Venezuela on the occasion of Chavez's death is the development of Venezuelan state capitalism. The very thing that Chavez said you had to avoid in the beginning, no? That we have to avoid Russia, the state capital, that's what it happened. And here's just a final citation. The bureaucracy is effectively a new class which, while not owning the means of production, administers them in its own interest and for its own profit. And it is now the fundamental block to any socialist transformation. Even Chavez recognized near the end of his life that Venezuela remains a capitalist society, given that state's control of oil, the central motor of the economy, it is a state capitalism. But it is a state capitalism, but a capitalism nonetheless. Thank you.
Okay, so after this wonderful background, I'm just gonna try to talk about the last year, an assessment of the last year, and I'm gonna go through 4 points that are more or less gonna guide my my speech, and it's gonna be first how Maduro came to power, then what situation did Maduro encounter when he came to office. Then the response of the PSUV of Maduro to move to the right, and then what we think, you know, the solution should be, which is a left-wing solution, a left-wing alternative, and not moving further to the right as it's currently happening. So Hugo Chavez's illness was made known in June 2011, and from then on until his death, he was constantly traveling to Cuba to seek treatment for his cancer. And during this power vacuum, Nicolas Maduro, the current president, was the one filling most of what Chavez needed to do at the time. And Nicolas Maduro was the vice president at the time, and before that he was the foreign minister. You can see actually a chapter in Democracy Now! Talking to Amy Goodman as the foreign minister a while ago. I don't remember what year. At the end of 2012, as the last election that Chavez was present at approached near, he publicly appointed Nicolas Maduro as the candidate to vote for if his illness caused him to die. Here it's clear once again the lack of internal democracy that PSUV suffered from. Candidates were rarely elected, and most decisions, including the most crucial ones, were always made from above. And as historian Mike Gonzalez, who wrote this book, who he's quoted before too, In a democracy, a dynastic handover of this kind is extremely problematic, but in the emotional turmoil that followed Chavez's death, that issue was forgotten. The PSUV's structures, however, did not allow of any real process of nomination and selection of a new candidate, even had Chavez not given Maduro his personal seal of approval. In the 6 years since its foundation, it had become very clear that the party was an apparatus of power, the political organization of the new bureaucracy that had emerged in the same period. So this is again to recognize the limits of the party in power, and those who are still in who are still the ones in charge of the PSUV. As some already explained, the PSUV, far from being a vanguard revolutionary party, it was always, I argue, a way to unite the left under a bureaucratic layer of leaders who would control the masses. And this is not to say that Chavez and the people who formed the party with him didn't actually have the genuine intentions of building participatory democracy and socialism from below. But it is to say that the way it was done and run made it so that those grassroots democratic processes didn't organically develop, and it just came to be what it is now. Quickly after he died on March 5th, 2013, Maduro defeated right-wing's most charismatic candidate, Enrique Capriles. And I wish we had the PowerPoint, because I would just be showing to you all these faces and moments. But so this was a victory, right? Because like Nicolas Maduro did win, but it was only with a margin of 1% of the vote, which Chavistas are normally used to getting a 10% margin. So it was received among the layers of Chavistas more as a defeat, even though officially it wasn't. The situation since Maduro came to power hasn't looked good. Venezuela is currently facing what I think are the most difficult times of the Bolivarian Revolution, and this is due to both external factors hostile to the project of socialism of the 21st century, as well as internal contradictions that Tom has talked about with socialism of the 21st century. That has caused it so that the government is actually going to the right. These are all factors that strongly influence the decreasing popularity of the new face of Chavismo. As Mike Gonzalez once again points out, even when the problems and failures of Chavismo and the excessive power of the boliburguesía, or the new bureaucracy, was the talk of every marketplace, Chavez was exempted from responsibility for its emergence. Maduro will not be given the same concessions. He has to win the support which Chavez, mistakenly and with sometimes very negative consequences, took for granted. The right, of course, knows the weaknesses of having an untested new leader taking over for Chavez. In lieu of this, a new and more confident and aggressive face of the counter-revolution was launched by the national bourgeoisie backed with the United States. The electoral campaign of April 2013 really wasn't over until the cries of the right for fraud were done with after the failure of the opposition to gain allies internationally to support this claim and delegitimize Chavez. Maduro. This is only one of the many different strategies the counter-revolutionary right-wing uses to get rid of all the attempts of the government at national sovereignty, anti-neoliberal planning, and anti-imperialist policies. The other, you know, he's gone through most of the most important ones, the 2002 coup, the 2004 coup referendum, the oil lockout. This time around, once the allegations of fraud failed to bring Maduro down, a much more dramatic tactic came to the fore. Some sectors of the right wing, known as the hard right, which are represented by Leopoldo López, María Corina Machado, two of the most wealthy people in the country, and they are alongside with Enrique Capriles, the candidate, the opposition party candidate. They are just part of the same party, but basically there's been a little bit of a division on like the hard right wanting to do anything they can to bring Maduro down, and the soft right basically being like, we'll just wait for elections to do the same thing, which is still bringing Maduro down. So they called in February 12th of this year for people to go into the streets and not retreat until Maduro stepped down. In the mainstream news, these events have been presented as that of students protesting for their rights to democracy, to living in a safe country free of crime, and to having a promising future in whatever career they choose, similarly to the social unrest, to the protests that that have been happening in Greece, in Spain, you know, the indignados. We see this together with the image of a massive repression on the part of the state against the peaceful protesters. But these protesters are mostly coming from the middle and upper class and led by the right, especially those with explicit objective of getting rid of the president. This is not to dismiss those who are truly facing the hardships brought by the hardest economic and political crisis of the last 15 years, which I'll talk about next, but to put into perspective the claims made by the Venezuelan right wing and most of the US media. As of today, there's about 40 people who have been reported dead, and about a little bit over 50% of those are Chavistas. But if we follow most media, it seems like all the violence is coming from the police, a state-controlled force that is only there to smash freedom of speech. So, okay, but why are people actually responding to these calls from the right to bring Maduro down? As of this year, the economic situation has proven very difficult for the middle class and most of the working class. And here are some examples of what's going on, but I can put a lot more to explain the economic situation right now. Inflation figures are up to 60%. Oil production, as Tom was saying, continues to be the main provider of funds for the country instead of the very many areas that there was diversification of the economy that was supposed to happen. External debt is becoming unsustainable. The lives of working people are suffering a setback, as we can see also by the attacks on salaries, the continuous deprioritization of workers' demands to control their workplaces and to fund those projects. Like at the beginning, it seemed like they were helping to fund these projects, and then they like stopped basically. And you know, even though workers obviously would want to continue that process forward if we want to see socialism from below. There's also the superficial scarcity of goods that the bourgeoisie is provoking. And even the social programs, the misiones that Tom was talking about, bringing free education and healthcare to the people with no access to them, which this was one of the most important trademarks of the Bolivarian Revolution, have been deprioritized, and in many cases, they are even being defunded right now. This crisis is, no doubt, in large part caused by the attempt of the capitalist class to defeat the revolution through hoarding, black market smuggling, and violence. But I think it'd be insufficient to only blame it on those factors, on those external, like counter-revolutionary factors. The corruption of the top layer of the PSU, of the PSUV, is also well known among leftists in the country and working people. And the death of Chavez has made it so that a very wealthy bureaucratic leadership without a clear economic policy towards strengthening socialism has established itself comfortably into the party. And so what is Maduro doing to confront this situation, this economic crisis, this political crisis, this last year after Chavez passed away? He's basically choosing a route of reconciliation with the right wing. I really wish we had the slides. Yeah. So he's choosing this route on the grounds that a coexistence of models, so this is substituting the socialism of the 21st century. We are talking now about a coexistence of models. We need to pact with the capitalist class to make this country run. That's what Maduro is saying. On the grounds that this is what will bring peace and stability to the country. So his response to the violence brought by a counter-revolutionary right-wing leadership has been that of calling for what he names the peace talks, and that's really what's going on right now. In the slide, I was just going to show one of the pictures of what these peace talks look like. It's basically, all men entirely, most of them white, in suits, and it's Maduro and a lot of the right-wing opposition and the wealthiest businessmen of the country. And that's really who is there to pact about how to bring peace into the country. There's no working class representatives, there's no peasants, there's no women collectives, etc. And so the question here is, how are those who do the hoarding, call for violence, and consistently hijack the revolution the ones to be consulted with and the ones to make agreements with for the purpose of real peace? These talks are one of the main examples of how Maduro is moving to the right, like looking at that layer in order to see how can we stabilize this country, how can we move forward to achieve socialism, which is obviously not the main objective right now. There's other measures too. There's, for example, peasants at the beginning of Chavez's presidency were gaining back all this land from wealthy landowners. And it's now being threatened to have these lands taken away and given back to those wealthy, rich landowners. So that's one of them. There's also this workers in Suramericana, which is a company that makes the oil barrels. They just got slashed 60% of their salary. This is like this week. And then the most dramatic event of the past 2 weeks, which I think is really significant, is how Jorge Giordani, who was the minister of the economy for many years and then minister of planning. He resigned. He basically resigned, saying that since Maduro took power, only a corrupt layer of the party is the one making the decisions, and that they have abandoned the revolution. This is what Giordani is saying in his resignation letter. This is really significant. He's been a revolutionary for many, many, many years, way before Chavez came to power, and he's been one of the main supporters of the revolution. So with this last event, another significant part of this is that banking giants Merrill Lynch and Bank of America have expressed their favorable support to Giordani's departure by stating that with him gone, and I quote, the radical wing of Marxism is finally substituted by a pragmatic wing of socialism that they say now they can actually work with, which obviously, yeah, says a lot. And people like Giordani and many Chavistas will blame this on Maduro as a president, but I want to argue that this development towards a reconciliation with the capitalist class instead of a break towards socialism was already underway with Chavez alive. It has been, I think, the result of these contradictions that we've been talking about, that Tom has been talking about, with the type of socialism that PSUV was promising. It has been, it is part, unfortunately, of the legacy of Hugo Chavez, I think. So now, what's next? What can we expect from the left in this country? What can we, you know, what can happen next? And I'm just going to point at this event that is going to happen at the end of July, the 26th of July. There's the Third National Congress of PSUV. Nicolas Maduro called for this National Congress to have all the layers of the party come together and vote on decisions on how to move the country forward. And talking to revolutionaries such as Gonzalo Gomez, he's really close to us in the ISO, and he writes, we translate a lot of his articles for Socialist Worker. He's very skeptical about the democratic processes used at this Congress, as well as the different points scheduled to be touched on. Basically, they're going to be talking about, again, the need for socialism of the 21st century, for participatory democracy, etc. But they're not going to assess the last 15 years. That's not in the program, at least, the assessment of the last 15 years, balancing why we're talking about, again, the need for these things, but then what happens to this? Why haven't we implemented it in a way that makes sense and that is actually moving the revolution forward? We're just talking about doing it, but we're not actually assessing the practice of it. So as the time for this conference approaches near, there's been forums that have been set up to discuss the most pressing issues facing the Venezuelan left. Marea Socialista, which is the group that Gonzalo Gomez is a member of, and they're also the closest to us, to the ISO, announced just yesterday a call for an open conference that they're going to have a week, just a week before the PSUV National Congress. And this is specifically to pull as many Chavistas and working people as possible to pressuring the party from below into actually moving towards socialism, grassroots democracy, etc. So they're basically strategizing, like, what can we do, the base, what can the base do? Those who agree with the revolution but don't agree with the direction the party is taking, what can we do to propose this and to actually force the leadership to take our position, the position of the majority, the position of the actual revolutionaries? Then also, two more points of like how the situation looks like before this Congress. Talking to comrades there in Venezuela, I am told that the working class is not the most... it's not at a state of like actually being collectively organized enough to fighting capitalism independently of the party right now, and that's really one of the main challenges, I think, of the left at this point. The working class is Chavista, but not collectively organized. All the hopes for workers' control of the economy that has been promised again and again have not yet been materialized. And then lastly, the other aspect that I wanted to mention too that I think is important for us as socialists is that, also coming from a feminist there, is that we, you know, like the whole revolutionary process, the Bolivarian Revolution, was at the beginning explicitly like, we're feminists, you know, we're also for women's empowerment, definitely it's one of our main things, and then, you know, we're not, like, we've heard this before, but they basically have delayed this issue to be addressed after the revolution. It's something that is no longer important before, you know, socialism comes about. And I think as socialists, we really need to understand that that's not possible. We can't actually achieve socialism if we're not fighting alongside with women's liberation, with all, you know, against all oppressions at the same time. It is thus a daunting task, but if we want to see the Bolivarian process moving towards socialism, as it's been proposed again and again since the formation of PSUV, the revolutionary left needs to achieve a strong enough level of organization that it can pull the masses into action, into the defense of the revolution all the way, independently of what the party is doing. This would entail an actual challenging from the part of the working class of the capitalist relations of production, which in turn requires a higher level of cohesion as a class fighting collectively against capitalism. It needs to involve all the working and popular classes and have a sharp understanding of the need to fight oppression alongside the fight against capitalism. And then, you know, finally, we as anti-imperialists in the most powerful country in the world need to be in full support of the efforts that this revolutionary left is doing to push this revolution forward. We should definitely, you know, be on the lookout, like, see what's going to happen at this Congress, see what's going to happen at the Open Conference with Maria Socialista. It's all public. It's going to be probably translated for SW, Socialist Worker, and then what's happening at the Congress, and then what's happening after that, you know, like, depending on how that Congress goes, we'll see what's going to happen with the revolutionary left. Can the revolutionary left still continue to operate as revolutionaries within the PSUV, or do they need to form an alternative? And that's, I think, the main question that I would love for the discussion to take on. That's it.
Thank you.
The preceding program was a production of WeAreMany.org, a website dedicated to publishing radical and activist media that promotes a better understanding of today's world while also putting forward a vision for a better future. We Are Many is a project of the Center for Economic Research and Social Change. To learn more about this program or to find others like it, check out WeAreMany.org.